Muscle, the podcast is starting.
Hello, and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I'm your host, Cassie.
And I'm Joe.
And we're here to do Chapter 6 of Prisoner of Azkaban, Talons and Tea Leaves. It feels more natural when we do the introductions before the chapter title. I've been messing that up since we started Prisoner of Azkaban.
It's not my book to introduce, so however you want to do it, it's up to you.
Okay, great. Thanks for your permission of how to do things on my podcast that I do all the work for.
I'm just Joe. I'm not the host. That's the important part.
No, you're at best a rotating chair.
My chair does rotate. Big improvement from my previous chair, which was it did rotate, but you rotated it in order to change the height, and it only went so high.
It was also, I'm pretty sure, made for children, and so it covered like maybe half of Joe's butt, and it was not suitable for working from home.
Yeah, it was nice lower back support, but only lower back support.
Yeah, and it wasn't designed for that.
No.
But now you got that fancy Herman Miller, and Herman Miller is a wizard of chair things. And that's my segue into the chapter summary.
All right, sure.
It's my turn to do the chapter summary this week. It was supposed to be my turn last time, but again, our guest took on our challenge, or guests, because we had two guests last time, which was the first time we ever had two guests.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was fun. I also realized in hindsight one day when I was driving home, like, that's the first time we had a male guest on the show.
Well, you do often go into your lady pod squad.
Yes, that is how I found our previous guests.
So it's understandable.
Yeah, the selection process there was maybe not as open as it could be. All right, chapter summary time. Chapter 6 of Prisoner of Azkaban, Talons and Tea Leaves. Joe is getting a timer ready because 30 seconds for the chapter summary or less. And here we go. Harry, Ron, and Hermione have their first day of classes at Hogwarts. Malfoy teases Harry for fainting at the Dementors. The trio goes to divination class, where Professor Trelawney predicts that Harry will die soon. Ron is shook, but Hermione thinks it's nonsense. They also go to Care of Magical Creatures, where Malfoy is attacked by the hippogriff Buckbeak after insulting it.
18 seconds.
Yeah, it was a very short chapter summary that I wrote, and then I went on to write three and a quarter pages of notes typed.
And I don't know what size font that is, but it looks
small. It's size 11.
Single space.
Single space. Yeah, of course. I don't like to waste paper. So buckle up, because this might be a long one. Okay. So
I guess let's start in the beginning.
That makes sense. Yeah.
How into Malfoy's teasing of Harry do we want to get?
Into it, but in the wrong way.
All right.
I wrote half a page of notes about Pansy Parkinson today.
Sure. I mean, this is the first time Pansy seems to be like doing anything.
That's the thing. Yes. So I highlighted Pansy Parkinson's name in this chapter and said, is this the first time that Pansy Parkinson appears? And no, she apparently was in Philosopher's Stone, but I don't think we ever really talked about her in any capacity.
She's just name dropped more than anything else.
She's just one of those like background characters.
She's like, here's proof that there is a girl in the Slytherin house.
This is true. She is like the only Slytherin girl that we meet. So I want to talk a little bit about Pansy, but I think it's helpful if we first set the stage about Draco teasing Harry. So if you'll remember, on the Hogwarts Express, the Dementors came and freaked everybody out, and Harry fainted. And somehow word of this got around to Draco.
Neville is responsible for that. I don't know to what extent.
When
how
was
he
Neville
did it.
Talking to Draco?
I feel like it's just Draco overheard Neville saying maybe something. Mm-hmm. There's no situation where Neville like went up and was going around, Harry fainted, Harry fainted. It was probably like Neville was like talking to Ginny as they were walking by, genuinely concerned. Mm-hmm. And then Draco overheard.
Yes. So Draco has been going around teasing Harry for fainting in front of the Dementors. And Fred and George are upset by this. And they're like, he came running and screaming into our compartment when the Dementors were around. So I don't know why he's acting like you overreacted now. And I think Fred and George do a good job of like affirming Harry and being like, nobody likes them. They're bad. Like, even our dad had to go to Azkaban once, and he was like messed up for a few days afterwards.
Yeah. And they're very calm in this scene. This is like the most calm we ever see Fred and George.
Being like real people.
Yeah.
And I should note, Arthur went to Azkaban like on ministry business. It wasn't like, oh yeah, Arthur was locked up for a few days.
No,
it wasn't
you
like that.
You don't get hired back in the ministry for that.
I don't know. Maybe in Arthur's department, it doesn't seem like it's a very important one.
Although if you do get accidentally sent to Azkaban, you do have to be hired as a teacher. That's how Hagrid gets
okay.
in.
Okay. All right. I really had to think about that one. I'm like, who else is a ex-con? Which, like, good on Hogwarts if they're hiring ex-cons, but Azkaban
but also, like,
doesn't
he's
seem
not
like a,
really an ex-con. That was, he was wrongfully accused.
And imprisoned. Because apparently there's no judicial system either. All right. So Draco has been mocking Harry for this. And Pansy appears as just like one of the background people sort of supporting the teasing. Mm-hmm. So like I said,
but like she's the only one that addresses Harry in this scene. She's the one that shouts out, hey, Potter, there's a Dementor behind you or the Dementors are coming.
Yeah. It's not a good look for her. She's not a good person, but... So, like I said, I highlighted her name and asked if this is the first time she appeared. No, it's not. Although in this one, she is described as having the face of a pug. All right. So
Pugs are cute. I would not want to see a humanoid pug.
I think that pugs are an abomination. I think that they are one of the worst things that mankind has wrought. They are so messed up biologically that it's offensive to me that people fetishize them. I don't like the way that they look in the slightest. And it is so messed up to want to have a dog that can't breathe properly and whose lifespan is affected because people think it looks cute for them to be all scrunched up like that.
I mean, while that's true to an extent, you're more thinking of bulldogs. That's where it's...
No, it's the same thing for pugs. My dad had a pug, extent. And that thing was, I swear, a demon. It was horrible, and you could hear it breathing from across the
house.
They
do have serious breathing problems. It's just worse when they're bulldogs because they're bigger and they can't actually support the size of their lungs.
So I hate
the oxygen
pugs.
They need. Pugs are still adorable.
I don't agree.
You can't convince me otherwise.
Okay, well, I'm not going to try. So... I wanted to do a little background on Pansy because I'm like, clearly the first time she appeared, I didn't care to look anything up about her. So I actually think that I have read this quote before. It's a quote from one of the few comments that Rowling has made about Pansy. She said in an interview that she loathes Pansy Parkinson. She said, I don't love Draco, but I really dislike her. She's every girl who ever teased me at school. She's the anti Hermione. I loathe her. And so if we're combining this with kind of our background knowledge about Hermione being kind of a self-insert for J.K. Rowling, at least that's where the character started of Rowling thinking about herself when she was 11. I think that Pansy embodies then the teenage girls that teased Rowling when she was a child, presumably. And I did some general Googling about Pansy because there's really nothing... No, like, backstory or anything interesting for me to comment on, which is maybe why we never really talked about her. And the first thing that I found, or the first thing that I clicked on, was a fanfic on Archive of Our Own called Ugly in Defense of Pansy Parkinson. Please note, I have not read it yet, so I have not screened the content. It is rated teen and up, so I don't think there's anything, like, horrifying.
So why bring it up?
I bring it up because I think that it brings us back to conversations that we've had about how evil characters in the series are often ugly.
Yes, immediately.
Yeah.
That's how J.K. Rowling is like, you can tell.
Yeah, it's like she immediately others them if they're like, they're ugly and they're a bully. As if like their list of offenses, like being ugly is... ahead of being a bad person, or if it's somehow like all ugly people are mean. So like that alone is annoying, and Pansy is one in a trend of that. But the fanfic is also amusingly tagged Rage Against the Internalized Misogyny Machine. More on that in a minute. But it's also written by a user whose username is Dirge Without Music, which is one of my favorite Edna St. Vincent Millay poems. So I liked that cut. But I think the internalized misogyny conversation needs to happen around Pansy. And I think that it's one that we're going to have to return to as the series goes on and as our cast of female characters like expands beyond just Hermione and like a couple of background characters.
I mean, like, Ginny's there. She's still more or less just a background character.
Yeah.
But
at this point, and
yeah,
unfortunately, pretty much for the whole series. So like, it's no secret that you and I love Hermione. We spend, yes, I would say, a good portion of our episodes being like, Hermione's the best. J.K. Rowling's track record with other women, particularly teenage girls, is not great. Like, I think that Hermione is an important character. And I say that as a young girl who was like inspired by Hermione and reflected in many ways by Hermione. But I never want to say like, yeah, the Harry Potter series has great female characters because it's kind of just Hermione. Everyone else, there's like something that's like,
like they were shortchanged drastically. Yes.
And I think Pansy is one of those. I found a really good blog post on a website that has a perhaps slightly profane name, so I won't say it aloud, but I will link it in the show notes because I don't want to not credit them, but I don't think that the name is appropriate. But the author of the post is writing about Pansy Parkinson and the internalized misogyny behind the Harry Potter series. And the author writes about the clear patterns of sexism, gender essentialism, and girl hate in the books, citing the lack of strong relationships between the female characters and how instead most of the female characters act as direct foils to one another. So going back to that quote that Rowling said in an interview about Pansy being the anti-Hermione, that sets up a foil. A literary foil is like a character that contrasts another. So like Draco is Harry's foil. Mm-hmm. Hermione's foil is apparently Pansy.
And Ron gets Crab and Goyle.
Ron's important enough to have two foils.
You could also argue Crab and Goyle don't equal one person.
Oof. Okay, but back to Pansy. So in Pansy's case specifically, the author of that blog post is upset about how other evil characters, or at least cruel characters, I think it's a little far to say Pansy Parkinson is evil at this point, but Harry's other bullies, which happen to be men, are frequently given character arcs, room to grow, complex motivations, but Pansy exists simply to be a mean girl. And J.K. Rowling seems to have created her as like a stereotypical teen girl bully and seems to want to like exact her childhood revenge fantasies on Pansy by making her like ugly and everybody hates her. And like, not even Draco really even seems to care about her. If you look at the way Pansy is treated Longtail in the rest of the series and beyond the end of the books, it's just kind of disturbing. And
now, to play devil's advocate here,
go ahead.
Going back to
favorite tradition of white men,
going back to Crab and Goyle, what kind of growth and arc are you seeing with them?
So I agree that Crab and Goyle are flat characters, much in the same way that Pansy is. But I don't think that there is a recurring trend or some kind of ism behind Rowling's treatment of Crab and Goyle. They're kind of just like cartoonish thugs, whereas Pansy is very much a cartoonish version of a teenage girl bully. But we have a lot of other male characters who aren't just cartoonish thugs.
Yes.
We really don't have a lot of other female characters.
Especially right now to look at. Yeah.
And I think that there are a lot of female characters who appear from like book five beyond. And some of them, I think, are a lot more positive than Pansy. They're a lot more likable than Pansy. Mm-hmm. But each of them, and this is something that blog post I referred to laid out in a way that made sense to me, each of them kind of gets a foil as well, a female foil in some way. And I find that really interesting. I don't want to harp for like too long in this episode about Pansy Parkinson, who truly is a background character. But as we kind of unravel the flawed creation that the Harry Potter series is, I think that characters like Pansy don't really shake out too well, especially with her ending for the series, which we won't go into because it's a spoiler, but she does not get a happy ending.
Well, thinking of other female characters that not necessarily are introduced here because they're introduced earlier, but actually kind of do something. We have Lavender Brown, mm-hmm, and Pavarti Patil.
Yeah.
Both of which show up in our next scene at divination class.
Yes.
And are very bought into what Trelawney is dishing out.
Yes. I am so happy to talk about divination because I also have probably a page about Professor Trelawney. But the first thing I want to note is before they go off to divination class, they're in the Great Hall eating breakfast, looking over their schedules or timetables in the UK version. They change it to schedules in the US version, but we're reading the UK version. Yes,
Hermione
for some
does
reason.
Have her 10 classes today.
Yes,
10
recall
different
that
classes.
Hermione is taking every class.
Three courses starting at 9 a.m.
Yes, Ron is particularly bothered by Hermione's timetable. Harry
and
really doesn't
Hermione
seem to care.
Does not want to explain it.
No.
Hermione just keeps like, oh, what do you care? It's, you know, don't worry about it,
yeah,
Ron. Come
I,
on.
I made
Why
a deal
are you
with
asking
McGonagall.
Questions? McGonagall has it figured out. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. And this happens at least twice in the chapter. And at one point, Hermione says like, oh, divination was nothing compared to my, I think it's arithmetic class. Mm-hmm. And Ron's like, what is she talking about?
She arithmetic, hasn't gone to arithmetic.
She hasn't
been
there.
Because they
had
the last two classes with her.
Yeah. So that's setting up something that I don't think we can talk really any further about it without getting into a spoiler. But it's something to track as we go through.
Definitely. And then I guess if we haven't started divination, do you want to talk about our little knight?
I would love to talk about our little knight. So Harry, Ron, and Hermione are going to divination. That's their first class. And it is in the North Tower, which they, I guess, haven't really been to before. Or at least it's hard to locate the classroom because they get very, very lost on the way there.
Yes, they do. And it's interesting to say, like, they make a point of saying after 2 years, they still hadn't explored the whole castle. I have no concept of how big this castle is, especially for a castle that could have 50 total students, as far as I can tell.
I mean, we keep talking about this, but like Rowling has said, like there's probably like 1,000 people at Hogwarts at the time, but there are 10 people in Gryffindor House in Harry's year, boys and girls.
Yeah.
So like that math doesn't work out. I think that we are meant to assume that this is a large castle.
Yes.
As castles generally are.
And it definitely doesn't help that things just move on their own.
No.
So yes, I could see exploring it was difficult, especially they were a little distracted. They didn't have the free time that Fred and George definitely had during their first 2 years.
And like also they haven't been allowed to freely roam the castle, really. Their like nighttime roamings are illicit and it's like we're going to get into the library and out. You know, it's not like they're exploring.
Yeah.
But like thinking about it, there are definitely places in like my high school that I just never went. I think the first time I stepped into the art hallway of my high school, it was 10th grade.
The art hallway is just like the last hallway in the building. There was.
But like, unless you are taking an art class, there was never any reason to go there.
I think health was there.
I took that over the summer.
Okay. Yeah. There was a bunch of classes. I think that was history, too.
No.
There were a couple history classes in there. Just not all of them.
Our high school was a mess generally,
it wasn't
but
designed
like,
well.
It's not crazy to spend several years at a school and be like, oh, yeah, I never really went there.
Yeah.
Like there are plenty of buildings at my colleges because I went to like 3 different colleges that I just never entered.
And especially like there was no reason for them to go anywhere near divination because apparently you just can't get there until Trelawney opens it up.
Yeah, it's a trap door, I guess.
A trap door in the ceiling.
Yeah.
And then the class just waits there until Trelawney opens the trap door and lowers a ladder for them.
Yeah, it's wild. So they're heading up to the North Tower. They're wandering around. They go up like 7 staircases, which sounds awesome because I'm like, I would lose so much weight if I was waddling around Hogwarts all the time. Like when I was in college and I had to walk between buildings, that was probably like how I stayed in shape. And now I'm sedentary. So they're exploring around and they cannot find the classroom and they enlist the help of an, let's say, eccentric knight in a portrait.
I like him a lot.
I like him a lot, too. And I want to ask you, Joe, how do you pronounce his name?
All right. I highlighted it. Let me find, because he does not introduce himself. Immediately, he sees them and thinks they're attacking him.
Yes.
He's fully insane. He is a crazy person who's like embarrassed that he was caught falling off his horse. I didn't know that paintings could get grass stains.
Yes. So he's like panicked and trying to fight them. And then they're like, hey, could you help us? And he's like, I'm a knight. I help people. Of course, I will take you to divination. Yes.
We may not survive, but we will do our best.
How would you
Sir
pronounce
Cadogan.
His name? Cadogan. Okay. So for our listeners, it's spelled C-A-D-O-G-A-N. The Harry Potter lexicon says that it should be pronounced Cadogan.
Cadogan.
Which is backed up by a deleted scene from the Prisoner of Azkaban movie. He pronounces his own name as Cadogan, Sir Cadogan. Almost like toboggan.
Man, having him in that movie would have drastically changed the like
atmosphere.
The atmosphere. Yeah. I don't know why I forgot the word atmosphere.
I don't know. It's a goofy movie in some ways. Not like
in very few ways, though.
Yeah, I would say it is very serious, and it's not
like,
intentional.
The whole thing is like weirdly tinted, and
but
then
it
just
has
to have
fun
a colorful
scene.
Night.
It has that scene where they eat the candy and their ears explode.
Yeah,
yeah. I think that it highlights the like quirky aspects of Hogwarts.
Well. I would have liked to see Sir Cadogan in
okay,
there.
Okay, well, I have great news for you. There's a deleted scene you can watch. So that scene it pronounces it Cadogan.
Cadogan.
The name, according to the Harry Potter lexicon, stems from the Welsh name, and I'm going to spell it. And if you don't know about Welsh, it's a wild language. And so they spell this Welsh name C-A-D-W-G-A-N. And it's pronounced Cadogan, meaning glory in battle.
Okay.
Every single time I've read these books, in my head, I've pronounced it Cadogan, not Cadogan. So I am going to continue to call him Sir Cadogan.
It's supposed to be Cadogan.
Supposed to be Cadogan.
All right.
I pronounce it and the Welsh pronounce it as Cadogan.
All right. Well, we'll see how I pronounce it throughout this podcast.
Yeah, it could very well change.
It'll change every time I say it.
Yes. So I do want to note Galadriel compares him to Don Quixote and the White Knight from Through the Looking Glass, which I think are all good comparisons that mm-hmm. check out of just like, they're kind of crazy. And the Harry Potter Wiki also notes that there is a street called Cadogan Road in the Liberton area of Rowling's home city of Edinburgh. So it would not surprise me if she got the name from that. And Sir Cadogan has a long backstory on Pottermore.
Oh,
I am
boy.
Not going to read the whole thing because I say long. It's like three paragraphs. But it basically tells the story of him. He is a hot-headed and peppery knight during the time of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. He's actually friends with Merlin, which is fun. And he battles a creature called the... And this is another word that I very well might be mispronouncing. The Wyvern of Y.
Okay.
W-Y-V-E-R-N.
Sure.
Wyvern. I know it from Final Fantasy, so hop off. But so he fights this creature while riding a fat gray pony, which leads to the phrase in the magical world, I'll take Cadogan's pony, which means make the best of a bad situation.
Okay.
Pottermore also writes that he has insane bravery, their words, not mine, making him a good man in a tight spot, which I guess tracks because he does successfully get Harry, Ron, and Hermione to divination. And he is also said to have had 3 wives and 17 known children.
So is this a painting of a person? Like, was Cadogan...
He was a real person.
He was a real person.
Yes.
Okay.
Who someone then painted a portrait of...
Because I also would have accepted that this was like somebody painted a character from a story.
Well, that's the thing. The Merlin is a real person in the Harry Potter lore.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably King Arthur and Sir Cadogan, they're all real people, but they're legends.
Yes.
So who knows?
All right.
Yeah, this is his story. I will also note that I made a typo in my notes and I wrote he is also said to have had 3 lives, not 3 wives. So I was like, oh, wait, no, that's confusing.
Well, life 1, probably back in the day. Life 2 is in the portrait. And life 3, we're going to find out, maybe.
Yeah, in Harry Potter 2.
That was Chamber of Secrets. We're on three now.
Oh, my mistake. So that's how they get to divination. And Sir Cadogan will reappear both in this book
this
and
is
in
not
future.
The last you'll see of Cadogan.
Yes.
But speaking of like bumbling but happy-go-lucky people, I want to talk about before they leave to try and go find divination, they run into Hagrid, who talks about being up. He's been up since 5 getting his lesson ready and he's so excited about it.
And at first I was like, I wake up at 5:30 every morning to go to work. But then he says that the lesson is not until after lunch. So like, that's a lot of time.
Yeah.
He did not need to wake up that early. And like, presumably he has other things and responsibilities because he is still the groundskeeper. But yeah.
But also considering what we see of the lesson, like I know he didn't get to do all of it.
I would like we'll to see Hagrid's lesson plan.
Not even like what he wrote out, but like what was he actually hoping to do? It sounds like the prepping was make sure the animals weren't unhappy.
Put
and that
them
was,
in a field.
Hide them behind the trees.
Yeah, maybe he didn't get to the learning part of the lesson.
Yeah, because they took out their books. What did they do with them? He was like, you've got your books. Now you know how to open them. It's time for the magical creatures now. I'm like, well, what are we doing with the books, though?
OK, we'll get there.
Divination time.
Yeah, they get to divination and we meet Professor Sybil Trelawney in this chapter.
She's described as very thin. Her large glasses magnified her eyes to several times their natural size. She was draped in a gauzy spangled shawl. Innumerable chains and beads hung around her spindly neck, and her arms and hands were encrusted with bangles and rings.
She is said to be insect-like.
Yes, Harry sees her in the dark corner and thinks she's a large, glimmering insect.
And I will say, Trelawney is one of those few characters who look exactly the way I pictured them in the movie.
Yeah, like
they
that,
did a good
that was
job.
Good casting.
Yes. Oh, I will talk about the casting. All right, let's talk about Trelawney. Trelawney is the great-great-granddaughter of the genuine seer, Cassandra Trelawney. This is according to Pottermore, and it's mentioned in the books later on. Told you my name would reappear. That's the other Cassandra in the Harry Potter series, Cassandra Trelawney. And
we've
Pottermore,
already talked about the significance of that.
Yes. Go listen to another episode if you want to hear that.
We're not going
to
tell you which one.
Because I don't remember. So it's the one that where he goes to the bookstore.
It wasn't long ago.
No, it wasn't. So Pottermore interestingly specifies that Cassandra Trelawney was a genuine seer. So in universe, there are legitimate seers, and Cassandra Trelawney was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
This chapter casts various aspersions about Sybil Trelawney's actual abilities. But anyway, on Pottermore, J.K. Rowling also wrote that Trelawney is a Cornish surname and an old one at that, which is meant to suggest Sybil's over-reliance on her ancestry when seeking to impress, because Cassandra Trelawney is presumably like a well-known seer. And so her being like, yes, I'm Sybil Trelawney, she wants that to carry some weight. J.K. Rowling also said that she originally chose the first name Sybil, S-I-B-Y-L, as a reference to ancient clairvoyance, which I'll explain that in a minute. But her American editor changed the name to Sybil, S-I-B-Y-L-L. In the version that we're reading, which is the UK edition, it's spelled Sybil, S-Y-B-I-L-L.
Sure.
It's a nightmare. I don't know why they couldn't just pick one. So about those ancient clairvoyance that you referred to, in Greek and Roman myth, Sybils are female prophets whose prophecies emerged as riddles to be interpreted by priests. And the most famous of these prophets, and I'm reading off of mythencyclopedia.com, the most famous of these prophets was the Cumaean Sybil. Apollo, one of the Greek gods, offered to grant her any wish if she would, let's say, become romantically entangled with him. Sybil scooped up a handful of sand and asked to live 1 year for each grain of sand she held. Apollo granted her wish, but then Sybil refused to get with him, let's say. As punishment, Apollo gave her long life, but not eternal youth. So as Sybil grew older, she shrank in size, finally becoming so small that she lived in a bottle. When someone asked the Sybil what she wanted, she would reply that she wished only to die. It's just a fun story. I have another one.
Now, I know that you, like, as you age, you can get a little bit shorter. There's an end.
Okay.
It stops.
It's a myth.
Yeah.
So the other one about the same Sybil, the Cumaean Sybil, led the Greek hero Aeneas, I think that's how you pronounce his name. I've said it before on this podcast, Aeneas, to the underworld to meet his dead father, Anchises, who then predicted that Aeneas would come, that from Aeneas would come the greatest empire the world had ever seen. According to tradition, Aeneas's descendants founded Rome.
Okay.
Yeah. So a little bit of Greek myth for you all myth heads out there.
For the record, I would like to live long enough to be put inside a bottle.
Frankly, I think that if you asked Joe, would you like to live inside a jar? He would be like, yeah, sure. Like
I would have to be. No, I'd have to be tiny.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Okay.
Yeah. If Apollo was like, hey, Joe, do you want to shrink down and live in a little jar? You would be like, oh, yeah. Put me in, coach. all right. So back to Sybil Trelawney. Let's talk about the casting a little bit. So Trelawney is portrayed by Emma Thompson in the movies. She does a great job. And fun fact, my mom loves Emma Thompson for playing Eleanor in Sense and Sensibility alongside Mr. Alan Rickman, Professor Snape, although... Okay. Emma Thompson and Alan Rickman do not end up together. She ends up with the horrible
spoilers
Hugh Grant.
For.
Well, I'm using the actor's name, so you would have to know who the actor is playing in the movie in order to figure this out. Which there's more about Hugh Grant and his connection to the Harry Potter series, but I won't go that
what?
Deep.
Why?
He was offered the role of Gilderoy.
Why?
Hugh I Grant?
Think, yeah.
Do you know who Hugh Grant is?
That's maybe I'm thinking Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman is Wolverine.
Yeah, that's very different. I'm like,
different
why
people.
Would Wolverine be Lockhart?
Let's see. What have you seen with Hugh Grant? I did make you watch Bridget Jones's Diary. He plays the guy that's not Mr. Darcy.
I couldn't point at a single person.
I can't even remember his character's name in it. So and I love that movie. Let's see. He's in Love Actually.
So was literally everyone.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I'm going to pull up a picture of Hugh Grant for Joe. I hate him.
Okay. Yeah. Also, Hugh Jackman is
like
Australian.
Your dad a little bit.
Is it just the hairline that's making you say that?
That's a roast. Do you recognize him, though?
No, not
okay.
at all.
All right. Well, I think he was offered to play Gilderoy. I have that fact in my head, but that's not the fact that I wrote down. Okay. Emma Thompson plays Professor Trelawney in Prisoner of Azkaban. Emma Thompson was married to one Kenneth Branagh from 1989 to 1995. Who portrays Gilderoy Lockhart.
Okay.
Kenneth Branagh was offered the chance to direct the Prisoner of Azkaban movie.
Might not have gone well.
Oh, he's actually, well, he's a accomplished director, let's say.
Well, more the fact that, like, that's his ex-wife.
So, yes, when they divorced, which was obviously well before the Prisoner of Azkaban movie was happening, was before the book had even come out, Branagh and Thompson cited their work schedules as the reason for their divorce, but it was later revealed that Branagh was having an affair with Helena Bonham Carter, who would go on to play Bellatrix Lestrange in future movies. So... by casting all of these big name British actors, they got a little bit of, let's say, complicated relationships that might have materialized on set in some way. This one was happily avoided. And Branagh met Helena Bonham Carter when directing Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is a absolute horrible movie and a terrible adaptation of that book.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's some fun facts. I'm trying to think of other things that Kenneth Branagh has directed that you would know of. He directed Thor, the first Thor movie.
Oh, okay.
There was something else that I
Lockhart
saw.
Lockhart directed.
Week. Yeah.
Okay.
He does a lot of Shakespearean plays, both acting and directing them. He was in a pretty good adaptation of Othello.
All right. Well, for the sake of this moving forward at all.
Yeah, I went on a big segue here. Oh, hold on. I just need to read off a few
really,
other things that he's
really
directed.
Don't
he
need
directed
to.
Thor. He directed
Thor already.
The live action
You're
Cinderella
this for no reason.
Remember that one with
the new one?
Yeah, with Rose from Downton
okay.
Abbey.
They took away all the singing.
Yeah, it wasn't good. Let's see. Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit. Did you see that?
No.
Okay. He's a well-known director. It would have been a very different movie, I think, if Kenneth Branagh had directed it instead of Alfonso Cuarón. Okay, my last note about a backstory on Trelawney, because we got to move on.
Yes,
she
we do.
Also shares a first name with Sybil Leek, who is an English, or was, she's dead, an English witch, astrologer, occult author, and self-proclaimed psychic, who the BBC dubbed Britain's most famous witch.
Okay.
And Leek claimed to be a descendant of Molly Lee, who is an English woman, or was also dead, an English
really,
woman
the
accused
descendant of the dead woman is also dead.
An English woman accused of witchcraft during the Salem witch trials. So I think that's an interesting parallel just beyond the name, that both of them are like, that's my descendant. Like, I've, you know, they were famous. Don't you remember this witch? Don't you remember this seer? I'm pretty legit. And I don't know much.
Would you
about,
say both are phonies then?
Possibly. We don't know yet. I don't know much about Sybil Leek, but her Wikipedia page struck me very much as like one of those people that appears on like the History Channel, like when they're doing a documentary about something,
like,
and it's
ancient,
like
ancient aliens kind
of
thing.
Like one of those people that's like they're an expert in this really specific thing, but it seems like their full-time job is just doing talking heads for the History Channel. That's kind of what it struck me as.
Okay.
Yes. So that's my background about Trelawney. There's a lot that we cannot talk about with Trelawney because she ends up being a, I would say, fairly important character in the series.
Important, but I don't know if I would say major.
Right. Yeah. I was
it's
intentional.
It's significant that she exists.
Yes. So Trelawney opens up that trapdoor and allows the children into her, what's described as like a cross between an attic and like, what is it? Like a tea shop or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that she clearly, unless she has a timer of like, oh, 9 o'clock, the trap door opens.
She saw that they were there.
She summoned, like she used the spell to open the trap door and decided like, here's where I'll stand. I'll stand in the back dark corner for my entrance.
She also greets the students by saying, how nice to see you in the physical world at last, which I read that and I'm like, I wish I had started my classes like that when we switched back to in person from being on Zoom all the time. I'm like, I wish I read this chapter a couple months ago and that way I could have said that because that would be so funny. What a weird way to greet people.
That is insane. And it's like such... That is very much the like talk show person of like, you know, believe me, I can speak to ghosts.
She is a cartoon character of like a phony psychic. She says that the students may not have seen her before because she finds descending too often into the hustle and bustle of the main school clouds her inner eye.
Yeah.
Now, this is, of course, a very convenient explanation
for not mentioning her at all during all the other times Harry's been in the Great Hall with the teachers.
Right. But given some of the comments that Professor McGonagall makes about Trelawney, which we'll get to, I really wonder if nobody tolerates her presence in the school and she has been bullied out of like the staff room and the Great Hall.
I don't think so, because they didn't even bully out Lockhart, who they actively hated.
But like Lockhart, I think his ego is so big that he didn't notice that everyone hated him. I think Trelawney knows that everybody thinks that she is an absolute phony goofball.
I mean, it might be she knows it, and the more time she spends down there, the more open it's going to be, the more obvious it'll be. So rather than like being forced back down there, she's doing it to herself.
Bully her necessarily, but like she's not welcomed by the other professors. Let's say.
I don't know. We're only given one professor's perspective.
Yeah. But McGonagall is, I think,
McGonagall
a taste maker.
If we're going back to foils, McGonagall is the perfect foil to Trelawney.
Yeah, Trelawney is so much fun.
Speaking of things that makes McGonagall the opposite of Trelawney, she opens up by saying that reading books isn't enough. You just, if you have the gift, you can do it. If not, you can't.
Which begs the question of why is this a class?
Right. Well, if everyone tries it once, you'll find who really has that gift or not.
But like, why is this a class, you know?
Like, I would understand. Our future tellers, you know?
Right. But like, I would understand if this was like if they had to take an aptitude test beforehand, or if it was, hey, even if you can't do this, at least you can learn about the practices and the history.
That's kind of what it is, to an extent.
I guess.
Like, you know, she's teaching them the basics right now. If they get it, they would move on to the next one. This is an introductory course.
Professor
this is 101.
Chobani's lesson plan seems to be interrupt lecture to make weird predictions about the students and freak them out. Then let the students get hands-on practice, but constantly interrupt them to tell them whether they have the eye or not.
Well, like if you're going, if you have a student, if you have a class of students that are doing work, you're going to be going around and helping them do that work.
Right. But I'm not going to go around and tell them you're a terrible writer and you probably shouldn't be in this class because you'll never be able to write.
She's not handling Hermione well.
Hermione does not like Trelawney.
Does not like Trelawney. But yeah, speaking of, well, after she mentions that the book, like, you can't just read books and be good at this, Harry and Ron smile and look over at Hermione, who is already not having it. Like, this is like first 11 words out of Trelawney's mouth. And Hermione's like, okay, this isn't for me.
I've made a horrible mistake.
Maybe I didn't need to take every class.
Yeah. We'll talk about Hermione's reaction to all of this in a minute. I do want to note that Trelawney has them look at tea leaves. She has them drink tea and then like look at what's left in the cup and make predictions based on that. And Trelawney sees a Grim in Harry's tea cup, which freaks everybody but Hermione, seemingly, everyone out. Or not everybody but Hermione. A few people are like, it doesn't, no, I see like a horse.
If you look at it from this way and really squint, it's the Grim. If not, it's a donkey.
Yeah.
Ron thinks it's a sheep.
Yeah. It freaks a lot of people out, though, Harry included, and Ron. But a lot of people, especially Hermione, seem to be like, this is bogus.
Yes. And as she's going through, Hermione has some fun comments.
Yeah.
Before we get to that, I do want to point out a couple of the predictions that Trelawney randomly makes. One of them being to Neville immediately, is your grandmother doing well? Which is a terrible thing.
Yeah. And then he's like, I think so. And she's like, I wouldn't be so sure.
I would not be so sure. That's horrible. Poor
yeah.
Neville.
Oh, my God.
Everyone is now worried about Harry, but Neville's still over there worried about his grandmother.
Yeah. Why would you interrupt class for that? Like, just shut your mouth. And even if we're presuming that Trelawney is not a phony and can actually make accurate predictions, don't tell him that in the middle of class and then be like, now pay attention and look at those tea leaves.
Yep. Let's just move on. Pavarti seeing with her own eyes, Trelawney seeing that Ron is sitting right behind her. She tells Pavarti, beware of a redheaded man, which is just lovely.
Yeah. Good advice for us all.
She predicts like we're going to have flu at this time of the year.
She's like, oh, well, when we get to February, we'll be interrupted by the flu and I'll lose my voice.
And then one of us will leave forever.
You forgot
Easter.
Also, she tells Lavender the thing you're dreading will happen on, I think it's October 16th.
Oh, that's later on.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
Yeah. She makes all kinds of predictions just like sprinkled throughout her instructions to the students.
And it's true because like she calls on after she makes all those predictions, she calls on Lavender and Lavender is like tensed up, ready to hear something terrible. And she just asks her to bring over a teapot. And then she gives her the terrible prediction afterwards.
Yes. She
the
also
thing you're fearing.
She also tells Neville, once you break your first teacup, take one of the blue ones because I like the pink ones. And I think that that one is especially is clear about that parallel that Rowling is trying to make between like what she sees as phony fortune tellers and Trelawney, that fortune tellers are really, really good at reading people. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe in that stuff, I know that there are people that legitimately believe in like divination and fortune telling, but people who don't often say like fortune tellers are good at reading people. They can read people's body language really well and make very educated guesses about who this person is and what kind of world they come from and say things in a vague enough way that it kind of can work. And so for somebody like Neville, she obviously, if we're assuming that Trelawney is a phony, She obviously saw this kid, saw what a shaky, clumsy dude he is, and was like, he's probably going to break a teacup. And then when she says that aloud to him, that puts him on edge, and he breaks a teacup.
And she's already told him his grandmother is not doing well.
Yes,
he's shook right now.
Yeah. So there are interesting little hints here about Trelawney might not be what she professes to be, let's say.
Yeah.
And then we get to Transfiguration class after she sees the Grimm and raises this whole hoopla and freaks a lot of people out.
Did you want to talk about what Hermione does say to her before we go?
Sure. Add it in. I want to talk about Hermione in a little bit after we get to Transfiguration.
So Trelawney is going through all the stuff that's in Harry's cup. She says, the Falcon, my dear, you have a deadly enemy. Mm-hmm. And Hermione just goes, everyone knows that.
Yeah.
And Trelawney stares at her and then doesn't respond. Well, they do. Everybody knows about Harry and you know who. And Trelawney still does not address her. She just glares at Hermione before moving on and adding her other predictions. The club, an attack, the skull, danger in your path, and then the Grimm. And screams enough for Neville to break his second cup.
Yes. And a lot of people freak out about this. Harry is a little shaken up about it, and they go to Transfiguration class. And McGonagall has planned to talk about Animagi that day, which we'll talk about definitely at some point with this book. But she does her little transformation into a cat, and she's like, what is wrong with you all? You did not applaud when I transformed into a cat. And so Hermione speaks up and she's like, we had our first divination lesson this morning. And McGonagall's like, okay, I'll stop you there. Who is going to be dying this year? McGonagall goes like full sass in this moment.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
If it were not for the fact that I never speak ill of my colleagues, and then just stops.
Yeah. It's always like a hype moment when you're a student, when like the teachers bag on somebody else. They're like, listen, guys, low key. Like, and that is exactly what McGonagall is giving them in this moment.
Of like, don't worry about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one has died yet. She's done this every year. None of them have died.
Yeah. And she says like, well, Harry, since you're still alive, you'll understand if I don't exempt you from the homework now.
If you die, you need not hand it in.
Yeah. and like, I think that it is fun in a kind of sassy McGonagall way, which is a side of McGonagall that we see come out sometimes. But I think that this is also like a really good way of handling it. I do think she maybe crossed a professional line in some of her comments about Trelawney, but
true seers are very rare. And Professor Trelawney.
Yeah. And she says that divination, I think she's the one that uses the term imprecise magic.
Yes.
So McGonagall is stating her opinion here, but I think that she does it.
Well, she honestly is avoiding her opinion as much as possible.
She's making it clear.
She's making it clear what her opinion is while mostly just stating facts.
This is a line that I try to walk as a teacher, because like, especially with English, like topics come up about politics, let's say, and personal beliefs and political beliefs. And I try really hard not to state my own opinions. I will, you know, pop in a fact here and there if like something does come up. But if a student were to ask me my personal beliefs, I think I would do the same thing as McGonagall and kind of dance around it. But I think I would also say to them, like, consider who I am and how I conduct my class and the texts that we choose to read. And I think you can figure it out. And I think McGonagall is kind of walking a similar line of like, consider who I am and what you know about me and kind of my attitude, and that I'm a no-nonsense person. Do you think that I believe in divination? And she doesn't ask that question explicitly, but I think she kind of poses it to the students of like.
And she doesn't say I don't even think she's saying that divination isn't true. She says, you know, there are true seers.
It's
extremely rare, though.
Maybe the more accurate question is like, do you think that I think that Trelawney is legit?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that she walks that line pretty well.
And to an extent, she needed to say something.
She did. Yeah. And I like those moments, too, when Trelawney becomes like motherly in a way. I'm sorry, when McGonagall becomes motherly in a way, when she especially toward Harry is when that kind of like gets me, because Harry doesn't have parents. When McGonagall,
she's not signing that form though.
When McGonagall has Harry's best interests at heart, I enjoy that.
Yes.
Yeah. The anime guy thing is like a fun little drop in early on in the book here. I think we will have other opportunities to talk about that in future chapters.
Yes, but it's important to note that she does turn into a cat to show off her anime guy powers.
Yes, and we've known that she can do that since the very first chapter of the books. I think this is the first time we get a term for it, though.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. So now can we talk about Hermione's opinion about divination and Trelawney? Because after Transfiguration, Ron and Hermione get into a bit of a spat about this. Mm-hmm. Because Ron still believes in all of this stuff. He's like, I don't know, like my Uncle Alfie, I think, saw a Grimm and he dropped dead the next day. And Hermione is like going on about how this is silly and how it's nothing compared to her arithmancy class. And she says that people see the Grimm and die of fright. The Grimm's not an omen. It's the cause of death, which I think is a good kind of clap back to what we talked about when Harry went to Flourish and Blotts and the bookkeeper was like, yeah, people buy that book. And, you know, then they spend their next couple days like looking over their shadow and they die of fright.
Yeah.
So Hermione offers that similar opinion and she says, and Harry is still with us because he's not stupid enough to see one and think, right, well, I'd better pop my clogs then. Which we'll talk about Hermione's opinion first. I want to break down this term, pop my clogs, which is an idiom in the UK meaning to die, which you could probably figure out from the context. Pop in this context means pawn something. So popping your clogs means like when somebody dies, you sell their shoes because they don't need them anymore.
Okay.
So I thought that that was a fun turn of phrase. But I think that Hermione's skepticism of divination in this chapter is really, really interesting because we understand Hermione as a rational character. I would say that that is like her primary character trait is being like a rational, logical, reasoned person. But I think we also have to consider that she was exposed to the world of magic fairly recently. As a muggle born within the last few years, she got this like life changing information about this like secret society that's here. And she seems to have accepted that and indeed excelled at it. We don't know exactly what that process was of her like first learning that magic is a thing that she can apparently do. But like this is a world that she's thriving in, at the very least. We do know that. And so it's interesting for me to see where she draws the line between what is and isn't legitimate magic as somebody who doesn't know things about this world, because Ron is very freaked out about the Grimm because he presumably comes from a magical family that has this like legend of the Grimm, of this omen being well known to the point where he has like a family member, an uncle at Nintendo that can back this up, you know?
Yeah, he does say like most wizards.
Right.
Will, be afraid of the Grimm.
Right. So Hermione, 4 years ago, didn't know what transfiguration is. And she's cool with transfiguration now. But when she learns about this new kind of magic, she's asking questions about, is it legit? And I think that's interesting. And I don't know if it's that there's no tangible proof of divination that she can point to. Like with something like transfiguration or charms or potions, that's like a thing that you can see and it does something and she can't come up with a rational explanation to debunk it. But because divination is such like a mysticism, not something that's physical and tangible, I wonder if that's maybe part of it, or is it what we talked about before, it's something that she can't read a book and study and get good at.
Yeah, I think the line of if you don't have it, you just can't do it is what's going to make her so skeptical of just like, oh, yes, some people are good at just guessing. Is that what's happening?
Mm-hmm. I think that it might be both. I think part of it might be that part of Hermione that wants to be really good at everything and is like, well, apparently I can't be really good at this because I don't have this gift. And I think maybe she's partly motivated by that. I think she's motivated by the overall mysticism of it all. I think she's very much motivated by like meeting Trelawney and seeing what a weirdo she is. But yeah, I think Hermione's skepticism is a interesting character trait that maybe doesn't contradict her status as a muggle-born, but like, I don't know. I have to imagine that like you learn about a new thing, a new type of magic. How can you, with your limited experience of magic so thus far, just be like, oh, but that's not real. Like, that's a card trick.
On the other hand, you might also say, like, she had also just gone to arithmancy and Muggle studies and met two potentially better professors in
qualified
her opinion,
people
and learned something that felt more valuable to her.
Okay.
So especially even just supposing those, like, I'm going to ignore Muggle studies as a new magic, but arithmancy is a new type of magic she's being taught. Mm-hmm. Like, this seems more, not only more her style, but like, this just makes more sense, maybe.
Okay.
Or just like, the professor's better.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, like, I definitely had that experience with like science classes. You know, I was never one of those students that was like, well, I'm never going to need to know how to do proofs, so why am I learning proofs? But when I got into like chemistry classes, it was like, none of this matters to me. I don't care about what the difference between a compound and a mixture is. I'm not going to be a scientist. I'm not interested in this stuff. And I resent learning it. And I think that that might be part of it for Hermione, that she does not feel any kind of connection to this world of telling the future.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting character trait for Hermione to hate divination as much as she does. And this is like the first time that we see her, I guess, openly disrespect a professor like this. Like,
yes, and she's, Harry and Ron are so on board for it.
Yeah. Like, obviously she suspected Snape of trying to kill Harry in the past, but she kept that in the common room, you know, whereas mm-hmm. she's like speaking out during class, which I find a lot of fun. This chapter is so long. Like, I got through all the divination stuff. I'm like, yeah, they still have to go to Care of Magical Creatures.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Care of Magical Creatures.
Let's walk over to Hagrid's hut.
Yes.
Which, like, yeah, you got to be outside, I guess, but
they didn't give him a classroom.
No classroom.
In this giant castle, you couldn't find a room for Hagrid to teach in.
They realize they have lessons with the Slytherins mm-hmm. because they see Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle walking to Hagrid's hut as well. And then we get to the, how do we open our books? Hagrid's there. He's very excited. He's nervous. He seems to keep looking at the three of them for like approval.
Yeah.
Like, am I doing okay?
Which is very cute.
And then like immediately is downtrodden by like, I don't even know how to open our textbooks, man.
Yeah.
And this is the one time I'm going to side with Malfoy to an extent.
Yes.
Malfoy blurts out, how do we open our books?
Yeah.
You got to stroke them.
Yeah. And Hagrid's like, I thought you all would have figured that out. He's like, I thought
they were funny,
which
was the mindset mindset of him buying that
or selecting that specific textbook. Yeah,
I thought it'd be funny.
That is like me when I show my students a video and they just look at it like stone face. I'm like, I thought it was funny.
I liked it. Yeah, so Hermione has Scalotape holding her book closed before
Scalotape.
Either way. And a bunch of people have belts.
Yeah.
I think Malfoy had rope.
Yeah. Which way did he get that?
Yeah. That poor Flourish and Blotts employee.
Yeah.
If only he knew about stroking the spine as well.
You'd think that they would like print that on the back cover or something.
Right. Hagrid fully should have put that on the book list.
Yes.
Here's how to use your book without it eating you.
Or he should have just picked a different book.
I mean, keep the book that gives the right information. Just
I don't
tell
think
them
that
how
that
to use
was,
it.
I think that Hagrid was like, well, here's this really good like reference guide that has great information. And here's the one that's alive. Let's pick the alive one.
You know, you get to bring a little extra pet.
Yeah.
To school.
Yeah. Because Hogwarts isn't already filled with cats and
toads
and rats and bats and all of these things. So Hagrid decides for his first lesson, we'll use that word very liberally, for his first lesson.
You know, a lot of college courses are all about experience. They're certainly not in college yet, though.
So the lesson plan is to experience hippogriffs.
We're going to experience hippogriffs. Be careful. We are going to bow to this creature. And if it does not bow back, run away.
Yes. This is Hagrid's plan. So I have a couple things to say about hippogriffs. Not a lot. They're not an invention of J.K. Rowling or the Harry Potter series. They are a legendary creature born from the union of a horse and a griffin. Obviously, griffin, and hippos in Greek is horse. So that's where that comes from.
Now, is a griffin not half bird, half lion?
I believe so, yes.
So it's half horse, half bird, half lion.
Half horse, 25% bird, 25% lion.
None of the lion came through, though, except for like the talons are longer because of the claws. I don't know. But I'm going to read the books, the chapter's description.
Yeah,
of the
go ahead.
Hippogriff. They had the bodies, hind legs and tail of horses, but the front legs, wings and heads of what seemed to be giant eagles with cruel steel colored beaks and large, brilliantly orange eyes. The talons on their front legs were half a foot long and deadly looking.
Mm-hmm. The deadly looking part is the lion part.
Yeah.
It's just like a vibe.
Yeah. Lions give off that vibe. And that's what carries through.
Yeah. So that is what they are in legend, and how that was imagined by Rowling and by the creators of the film. I guess you can feel a type of way about the lion part not being represented, but that is where it comes from. Harry, that's actually all my background on hippogriffs. Okay. So
they're Hagrid, cool.
Yeah, they are cool. So Hagrid tells them, like Joe said, about how to approach a hippogriff. You have to be very respectful.
They understand English.
Yeah,
they understand
that's a conversation we have to have.
And if you insult them, they get mad.
Yes.
And Hagrid explicitly says that you cannot insult these creatures. They will not be happy about it.
Yes. Harry volunteers to be the first one to do the demonstration.
After what I'm assuming was a couple minutes of silence as Hagrid was sweating through his coat.
Which is how I learned I loved English class, for the record. When I was in eighth grade, we had our teacher was out on maternity leave for the whole year. And so we had a teacher who was very clearly like a new teacher. And she said she got the job like a few days before the school year started. And she would try her best. I'm not going to say that she was a great teacher, but she was really trying her best. Like, she tried to connect with us and make it interesting. And eventually, and maybe this was just the group of kids that I was in the class with, but there would be a lot of those like silences when she would ask, like, what do you think? And eventually I felt so bad for her that I would just like start participating. And then I was like, wow, this is actually great. Like, I actually like reading books and talking about them and writing about them. Huh, who would have thought? And now I'm an English teacher and now I'm the one that asks questions and my students stare at me and then somebody gets bored and uncomfortable and just answers the question.
Now, were you like Harry in that after you volunteered, other people actually started volunteering?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because like it breaks the ice. And as a teacher, that's like an intentional trick to just like stare at the kids until somebody answers. I guess maybe you don't have to deal with that so much at the younger grades because like kids are excited and they just want to talk. And whether their comments are relevant or not is more the challenge you have to deal with.
I've gotten very good at bending a random answer back on topic.
Yeah. And I have to do that to an extent, too. But like when I ask a question, my kids stare at me, I just stare back. You know, I got all the time in the world. I can wait. Somebody eventually will say something. And that's the teaching strategy that Hagrid is employing here. So Harry volunteers and he successfully bows to Buckbeak is the hippogriff that he's working with in this exchange. And Harry successfully bows to him, approaches him, pets him, and then flies on Buckbeak at Hagrid's urging. And Harry does not enjoy this experience.
No, it's very uncomfortable for him.
Yeah, which is like a contrast to the movie where he's like having the time of his little life on that thing.
I will, like, on top of bowing and not insulting hippogriffs, you also have to not blink.
Yeah.
If you blink, and Hagrid decides to tell him while Harry has eye contact, oh good, you have eye contact, don't blink anymore.
Isn't that a thing with some animals? Like, that felt like a legit thing.
So there are some animals where, like, you want to avoid eye contact because they take it as aggression.
Okay.
Or, like, show your teeth. There's others where, like, you hold eye contact to show dominance.
Okay.
Like, if you look away first, you are the non-dominant animal.
I guess for a hippogriff, you could kind of see it as, like, in a business interview, you're supposed to maintain contact to show that you're,
this
like,
is a very
paying attention.
Bird, or, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess I could see it being that for the hippogriffs. So Harry flies it. He's like, I would much rather be on a broomstick right now. I'm a jock.
Yeah, like this would be very cool for a muggle, but for someone who can ride a broomstick and does all the time, this just seems like it's a worse
way of flying.
Here's a thing I have to fear will also attack me if I get it upset.
Yeah, but that does break the ice, and it gets people more comfortable with approaching the hippogriffs and trying to participate in Hagrid's little activity here. Until Draco comes and ruins everything.
Draco, by the way, is successful. He bows to the hippogriff. He's mm-hmm. petting it. And he's like, see, you know, if Harry was able to do it, then it was definitely easy.
Yeah.
And then goes off to call Buckbeak ugly.
Yes, he calls Buckbeak an ugly great brute. And then Buckbeak attacks him. And this is where we have to talk about whether hippogriffs understand English or not.
They 100% do. They're business birds.
Like, the only way that I can explain this away is that, like, maybe they can detect the tone of the voice. Like, that's the thing with dogs, isn't it? That they pick up more on tone rather than the actual commands.
You can say literally anything to a dog, and they'll pick up the tone. They can get, like... Right. Like, if your dog is used to when you say you want a cookie, you can replace that with anything that ends in E.
Yeah.
And that dog is excited for a thing that may or may not be in your hand.
Right. And so I thought it might be a similar thing with the hippogriffs, but like, it also seems like they maybe just understand the English language, which raises so many questions.
I think they understand the English language.
I like that you stopped yourself from saying, I think they speak English.
Yeah, they understand English. If they had fingers, they would probably be doing sign language. That's not true.
Okay. But like, so if Buckbeak was raised in, let's say, Germany, would Buckbeak be able to understand if Draco insulted Buckbeak in English?
I have no idea.
Buckbeak
definitely understands English specifically.
Okay. So Buckbeak attacks Draco for insulting Buckbeak. Is Buckbeak what pronouns are we using for Buckbeak?
I don't know if Buckbeak gets pronouns.
Okay, so we'll use they. So Buckbeak attacks Draco. I will note that there is a...
Hold on, pause for a sec. Oh, yeah. So I'm going back through... this thing. And when Harry volunteers, Lavender and Pavarti say the tea leaves. Like, Harry, if you get near that buckbeak, if you get near that hippogriff, you're going to die.
Yeah.
This will be what kills you.
I'm glad that Lavender and Parvati found each other.
Yeah. Pulled the gray hippogriff away from his fellows and slipped off his leather collar.
Okay.
Buckbeak is a boy.
Okay. So, So Buckbeak attacks Draco after Draco insults him. And I will note that there is a wizard rock band called Draco and the Malfoys. And they have a song called Hippogriffs Deserve to Die about this experience, which I will link in the show notes so you all can listen to it. Very, very good. And Hagrid rushes Draco off to the hospital wing, and class just kind of ends there. They all follow Hagrid into the castle and then sort of just disperse.
Malfoy yells, I'm dying. I'm dying. Look at me. It's killed me.
And like... So about Hagrid's lesson plan, maybe there was an activity or a book reading that he planned to do after they kind of had their meet and greet with the hippogriffs. As a teacher and as somebody who understands dealing with dangerous things, you would maybe want to read the stuff in the book first, because the book probably expands on some of these ways to avoid danger. Because Draco very clearly was not listening when Hagrid said these things.
Well, he would have known if he could open the textbook.
But I don't know. I don't want to criticize Hagrid's lesson planning just yet. I maybe want to criticize Hagrid's barometer for what is safe and what isn't. But that's...
That's going to be called into question. It was called into question in the first book. It will continue to be called into question throughout the series.
It's a big conversation.
Hagrid's barometer for safety among children, among students, and just in general.
Yes. So Harry, Ron, and Hermione go to Hagrid's hut that night.
Before we do that...
Okay.
And then the last we see of Pansy Parkinson in this chapter, she gets the line of, I'm going to go see if he's okay. And no one else decides to go with her.
Yeah.
Crab and Goyle don't care enough to, Pansy's going to go see if he's okay. That's yeah. it. It's just like going full circle of, we talked about her in the beginning, and here's all the characterization we're getting.
Yes, that is
she
that
cares
is Pansy's
about Malfoy.
Role. Yep. So Harry, Ron, and Hermione go to Hagrid's hut that night to check in on Hagrid and see what's going on. Hagrid is
drunk.
He is soused. And Hagrid says he thought it would make a good first lesson. And I want to ask, as we're both teachers, is Hagrid in the wrong?
I would say if it had gone well, it would have been a really great first lesson.
That's the thing. I'm like, yeah, you want to grab the kids with something exciting on the first day.
Grab them with something exciting and safe, though.
But I mean, like, he did tell them all you have to do is not insult them. Like, he told them, like, you have to bow. Yep. And if it doesn't reciprocate, you need to back away. But like, he did give them safety warnings. And I think back to, like, chemistry class again, you're dealing with dangerous chemicals and they tell you, like, don't eat this, you know,
I will tell you this. In chemistry class, you didn't get to mess with chemicals on your first day.
Yes, that's
you
true.
You learned about them.
We had to watch safety videos.
You learned safety protocols. Yeah. And then you got to ride the hippogriff.
That's fair. So maybe if Hagrid really wanted to do hippogriffs, maybe if he picked a docile one, like a particularly like good natured one, and maybe did a demonstration for them, not let them approach the hippogriffs. That would maybe be a safer way of doing this.
But also, this man has access to so many, so many magical creatures.
Yeah.
He could have picked something safe for the first day.
He's like friends with the centaurs. Why not ask like one of the centaurs to come by and be like, hey, guys,
as
look,
a
it's
subject
centaur.
Would be really weird.
I guess they are like living, breathing, like
they
persons.
They know? Also understand English, but they can also speak it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just. Yeah.
They're also part horse.
It was really important that they learn about horses on the first day.
Yeah.
Not lions. Yeah. So I think Hagrid made a bad decision here. As he is wont to do.
Yes. But again, like, this could have been really cool if everyone had, like, pretty much everyone followed the directions and did the right thing.
That's the thing. Like,
and clearly he had been handling the hippogriffs. He was relatively confident.
They were tied down, too, which is something that they note that, like, these kids could have backed away. Like, if something really did go wrong in the bowing process, they could have.
No, he did take the collar off of Buckbeak before.
Oh, OK.
Harry bowed. Mm,
OK. OK. But like Harry says, when they're sort of consoling Hagrid, he says, you said hippogriffs attack if you insult them. It's Malfoy's problem. He wasn't listening. And I do think that Hagrid is at fault for picking something so dangerous on the first day and not giving an adequate like safety demonstration or lesson beforehand.
But also, if it can't actually kill you, knowing how good Madame Pomfrey is, why not?
Yeah, maybe. But I think that Harry is right, too, that like it is Malfoy's fault that he wasn't listening. Like if you as a chemistry teacher go through all of those safety protocols and tell people like this will burn your skin if you get it on your skin. So wear gloves and don't get it on your skin. And a kid is messing around in the back of the classroom and not paying attention, it's that kid's fault. You were given important instructions that you did not follow.
I believe the teacher would still be held accountable to an extent.
Yes, because they should have been watching and standing over that kid's shoulder and policing 30 children at a time in a classroom that's not ventilated and
to be fair, Hagrid, it seems like, did each kid one at a time, got them with the hippogriff, and then stepped away to do the next kid.
Yeah.
So like Malfoy had already been approved by Buckbeak to pet him.
Yeah. I think that this is Malfoy's fault. I think it's Hagrid is...
Hagrid is responsible, yes. But Malfoy is the reason it happened.
As a teacher, you are always responsible for...
Yes.
But like if it was up to me, I would absolutely... Like if I was the headmaster or the head governor or whatever on the school board, I would definitely, you know, give Hagrid a talking to and be like, you have to, if you're going to be dealing with dangerous creatures, you need to adequately prepare the children. This isn't something to do on the first day, and give him that, you know, disciplinary meeting or whatever. But I would not fire Hagrid over this.
Yeah.
I was interested to hear your thoughts.
But yeah, so Harry, Ron, and Hermione are very worried that Hagrid is fired. And when they find him drunk, they are not convinced he was not fired.
Yeah.
Hagrid does say it's a matter of time. It's going to be soon. And then they talk about how, oh, this is definitely Malfoy's fault. You were fine. And then Hermione convinces him to stop drinking and goes and dumps out his giant tankard of alcohol.
Which is, it's a fun thing, I think, in a way of, like, this little 13-year-old girl is taking care of this old man. But it also kind of just makes me sad because it feels like something that a child who deals with parents that maybe have an alcohol issue know how to do. Mm-hmm. And we know absolutely nothing about Hermione's life outside of Hogwarts. So beyond that, her parents are dentists and they like to go skiing. So it kind of made me upset in a weird way, but I think I was thinking a little too much about it.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely see it in both ways, but it does lean towards either way, Hermione shouldn't have had to do that.
Yes, and I think we also have to consider that the UK has a much different culture around alcohol than what we have here. Not to say that alcoholism does not happen in the UK, but Hermione might have a little bit safer experience in dealing with adults drinking than...
Yes.
Like a child in the U.S. might.
We do also get that Madame Pomfrey did fix him up, but he is saying there's still agony and he covered it in bandages.
Yeah, himself, not Madame Pomfrey did it. Because Harry is like, she regrew the bones in my arm in a night. He'll be fine.
He will survive.
Yeah. Which, good point, Harry.
And then Hagrid goes, dunks his head in some water to try and sober himself up. And then he's like, he's in the process of thanking them for coming and making sure he was okay. And then gets sober enough to realize, oh, it's nighttime and Harry is out. And flips. He is pissed off. And, you know, we could talk about him yelling at them, but the last line is what really hammers it home. Of he's sending them away after saying, how dare you, like, Harry, you shouldn't be out here. You two shouldn't have let him. Mm-hmm. But he ends it with, you know, don't let me catch you walking down here to talk to me after dark again. I'm not worth that.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't consider that in the state that he is in. I kind of thought it was Hagrid just saying, like, it is not worth risking your life to come see me. But I guess maybe if we consider that Hagrid is genuinely distraught about what happened today, that, you know, he might not be feeling so hot about himself today.
No, he definitely wasn't.
Yeah.
But no, I wasn't saying today is when he's not worth that. He's saying never. He was in a bad situation and it was good that he got help, but he would rather stay in that bad situation than Harry risk his life.
Yeah. 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 That is how I read it as well. Yeah. But I think you could make an argument for that. All right. So does that bring us to...
Spell of the Week. And our Spell of the Week is not a spell. It's kind of a bunch of spells, but also no spells at all.
It's a magical thing.
It's a magical thing.
Person, place, or thing.
We're going to be talking about divination. We're going to dive into this. We're just going to cover the whole thing. And there's nothing else to say about divination after this. So in the real world, divination is the attempt to gain insight into a question or situation by way of occultic standardized process or ritual.
And that is kind of what it materializes as in the Harry Potter series of all of these practices that are meant to give you some kind of glimpse into the future. But I think it is important that we note that it is an actual thing that is practiced in some religions and cultures.
Yeah.
So it's maybe not cool for J.K. Rowling to dunk on it as much as she does.
Put it in her magical world, but say it's still bogus magic within her magical world.
Yeah. And again, there is the whole there are people who can actually do it and actually see the future and genuine seers.
But there's also people who are scam artists.
Yeah.
Who justifiably should be taken down a peg. Everyone's opinion is a little different.
Yeah.
It is more formal and religiously charged than simple fortune telling. It dates back to a number of ancient societies like Greek and Aztecs.
Yes. So that's divination in the real world.
Some more information about divination in the wizarding world, though, is actually touches back on what we talked about with how divination should be looked at in the situation, in like their situation. Headmaster Albus Dumbledore had originally decided that this course should no longer be taught at Hogwarts, it being considered obscure and inaccurate at most. However, seeing that the applicant for the teaching post, Sybil Trelawney, was the great-great-granddaughter of Seer Cassandra Trelawney, Dumbledore decided to give her a chance.
Yes, and that's definitely something that we will have to return to.
We will return to it, but it is interesting to see, like, yes, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to teach a thing that you can't actually learn.
Yeah.
You definitely need to learn about it. You can't just, you know, look at tea leaves and decide what they mean. There's a process to it. Mm-hmm. But being able to interpret those correctly requires an actual seer.
An innate ability, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, that Dumbledore, who's typically our, like, voice of reason, maybe not reason, but a guiding force, I would argue, within the series,
yes,
thinks it's maybe bogus.
Well, at the very least, you know, why have a course
class that, like, 1% of students will actually excel at? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, this is, you know, setting a lot of kids up to fail.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So that's divination. That's our spell of the week. And that brings us to emails. We have two emails to
read. Two whole emails.
And you should see how big the smile on our faces are. So if you want to put a smile on our faces, you can send us an email to owlpost@potrificustotalis.com with your thoughts and your questions and your corrections and your commentaries and whatever you would like. But our first email is from my friend Jose, who has written in several times before. Thank you again, Jose.
Hi, Jose.
He says, "Hey, guys, I've been having a great time listening to the podcast again, especially since it's covering my favorite book in the series. The reason for my email today is in regards to a conversation about the night bus. You mentioned that Pottermore has it listed as being a thing before the creation of the first automobile. Do you remember that conversation?"
Yes.
Okay. For me, the first thing that came to mind was, what about horse and buggies? I looked into it, and by that I mean I skimmed Wikipedia, and it seems that there were horse-drawn bus services in Europe as early as the 1600s. They were a very popular service in France and were brought over to London in the 1820s. I would guess that these were what inspired the first night bus, where it was able to use magical creatures or magically enhanced horses to assist wizards and witches in need. As well, the night bus could have been multiple buses or also magically enhanced to hold more people on the inside. And this is the part where we place the gif of Homer Simpson leaning out of his car and yelling nerd, which I fully deserve. Just some fun speculation. Love the podcast, as always. Jose Luis, P.S. link to the wiki page, which I will link in the show notes. This did not occur to me in the slightest. I was like, it's a car.
Well, I think the important distinction is it's the way I read it was, it seemed like that was the bus the whole time.
That is the thing that, like, there is that part in the Pottermore article of, like, early on, a lot of people didn't like the night bus because it was using a muggle technology of the automobile. I guess you could make the argument that, like, a horse and buggy could have been muggle technology. I don't know.
I don't know.
I like this explanation as a way of filling in that hole.
It is a good justification. I might think that at some point J.K. Rowling did search up on whatever
Alta Vista
of, like,
ask when Jeeves.
When were there buses in London, and found without reading too closely a time before, what was it, 1865.
1865 is when the night bus debuted, and
but
the automobile
I could definitely believe
later, yeah,
that she saw a time before then when buses were a thing, but it wasn't actually automobile. Like, mm-hmm, it wasn't a bus with an engine,
yeah,
and just didn't look closely enough.
Yeah.
So that could be part of it. Or we can be nice and go with what Jose is saying.
I don't think it's being nice.
Giving her the benefit
of the
doubt.
Okay, nice to J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
Okay, sure. I mean, I never want to be nice to J.K. Rowling, but I do appreciate Jose's research to fill that in. So
yes,
thank you, Jose. The next email is from Viv, who has written in before as well. She says, "Dear Joe and Cassie, I'm so glad you're doing the podcast again. I missed it so much. I love the third book, and I'm so very excited to read it. I have a question for you. Is Harry aware of other magical schools at this point?" From Viv. So
I would say there's not a chance that Harry knows there are other wizarding schools. Harry still barely knows that this school exists. And he is fully convinced if he gets expelled from this school,
that's it.
That's it. He's done.
Yeah.
No more wizard. He lives under the stairs again and it's done.
It's an interesting thing that we've talked about with the series before, that we learn about this world through Harry's perspective, and we really only get Harry's perspective. And Harry is not an observant person. And that's the way a lot of fans over the years have filled in plot holes about the Harry Potter series, of like, well, Harry just didn't notice because he doesn't pay attention to these things.
I will point back to the Snape had a horse.
God.
Love that so much.
For those who don't know, Joe is referring to a Tumblr post that was mocking J.K. Rowling, like all of her weird revelations after the series has ended, about like, well, actually, this was happening the whole time. It's like Snape had a horse the whole time. It was never mentioned, but it was there.
Harry just didn't notice.
Yeah. But back to Viv's question. So, like, I think that Harry is so hyper focused on his own life and his own little world that it has not occurred to him that there are other magical schools than Hogwarts. And I do believe that when we are introduced to other magical schools, I won't say any more specific than that, it does seem like it is the first that Harry is learning about them.
Yeah.
Or realizing that, like, oh yeah, it couldn't just be Hogwarts. Yeah.
As far as he knows, there are only wizards in England. His only reference for another person who was expelled was someone who just stayed at Hogwarts and didn't go anywhere else.
Yeah.
And then clearly didn't go to a different wizarding school. He knows if I'm expelled, best case scenario, I get to help out Hagrid for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So I don't think that Harry is thinking globally.
In any way, shape or form, no.
But it's an interesting question. Thank you, Viv, for writing in. So again,
yes, thank you.
If you want to make our little day and put a smile on our faces, you can email us at owlpost@podtrificustotalis.com, or you can just visit our website and hit the email us button. And then obviously you'll have to write your email, but that will send us an email as well. And you can also leave us a review on wherever you choose to listen to podcasts. I don't endorse Apple's monopoly over the podcast world. I super don't endorse Spotify trying to form their own little monopoly over the podcast world. So just pick somewhere. Anywhere is fine. And leave us a review. That would make me quite happy. I think our last review on Apple Podcasts is from 2019. So it would be real nice to have a more recent one. And you can write good things. You can write bad things. You know, be honest. It'll still make me happy to see that somebody cared enough to leave a review.
Yeah. Even if it was just they were angry and wrote a review. Why not?
I'll
take a 1-star review.
I tell this to my students all the time. I'm like, you can tell me if you hate this poem that we read. You can tell me if you really like it. Of course, I want to share things with you that you really like. But if you really didn't like it, tell me, because A, maybe I won't teach that poem anymore. And B, that means that you're engaging with something and you're thinking about something and you're forming an opinion about something and being a critical thinker. And that's what matters. So be a critical thinker and leave us a review on a podcast website or app of your choice.
I have my students, after we read a story or listen to something, give me a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or thumbs to the side on how they feel about it.
Okay, I might have to start doing that. I get a lot of, I don't like it. Why not? I don't like poetry. Okay, but come on.
Well, it's nice. It gives everyone a chance to voice their opinion without them having to like really dive into it. Some kids just like, yeah, I liked it. I don't know why, I just liked it. I like to encourage that.
Yeah.
You can just enjoy something to enjoy something.
Yeah. Pedagogical tips from Joe. I wish that Hogwarts teachers could receive some of them. But otherwise, you can also subscribe to us wherever you find podcasts. Check out our website, podtrificustotalis.com, to listen to episodes and find our detailed show notes, where I link back to everything that we reference in the show. And it's helpful, especially when I have to refer to blog posts but not say the name of the blog. So you can find the show notes there and, of course, in your podcast app.
Is there an age rating you should say to look into our notes?
I would say, well, for this one, you know, I'll put a link. And
are you going to label it?
There's nothing particularly inappropriate. It's just the name, I don't think, is something that I would say in polite company.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the point. I don't want to be all puritanical about it, but that's where I'll leave it. All right. And you can join us for Chapter 7 of Prisoner of Azkaban,
The Bogart in the Wardrobe.